I never was anyone's straight man, and true to myself, I died doubled up on my side. Never let it be said that I don't amuse myself.
Welcome to this special masterclass recording from Thresholds, the International Short Story Forum. I'm Zoe Gilbert, and in this interview, I'm talking to Alison MacLeod about Anton Chekhov and her special relationship with him as a writer. Alison's latest short story collection, All the Beloved Ghosts, includes three stories inspired by Chekhov's work and life, which were originally broadcast on Radio 4. In this interview, I begin by asking Alison about those stories and how they changed her relationship with Chekhov.
A real person who is in three of the stories who I definitely feel that you're honouring in this collection is Chekhov.
Yes.
In a three stories that you wrote to be broadcast on the radio and that kind of fit together as moments from his stories or from his life. I believe he spent a long time reading Chekhov and researching his life in order to write those, which I suppose is part of the process of honouring the person. I wondered how that research and the writing of those stories in particular changed your relationship with Chekhov as a writer.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I suppose I felt I hadn't, you know, as a mature writer, done Chekhov justice. So as a short story writer, I hadn't read enough of him. I thought I read some of his stories at university. I think I wasn't mature enough or nuanced enough to fully see all the subtleties of his work. And also, I think probably a lot of the humour of it passed me by. I do find him incredibly funny, I realised. He's one of the few writers who makes me laugh out loud. And, you know, if you're someone who has read a lot for years, it's, you know, you're a bit hardcore. It's hard to make you laugh out loud.
You toughen up a bit.
You do. Yeah. But I sit there with a Chekhov collection and I really chuckle. And I read his diaries and I laugh even harder. If I could go to dinner with any dead writer, it would absolutely be Chekhov. And I think I would fall absolutely in love. You know, he was quite striking. He was very tall as well for his era. He was over 6 feet tall. And, you know, I just think he'd be absolutely charming, incredibly witty company. So I didn't really get that as a younger reader. And so in probably the last 7-8 years, I've been going back to Chekhov and never reading, you know, all 450 stories at one go. But I dip in and I dip out in different periods of my life. And he reminds me of just how I can see how absolutely amazing and light of touch his short stories are.
I think that's something I found in those stories of yours in this collection, actually. There was a lot of humour. I laughed out loud listening to them on the radio, especially the first one, the lady with a little dog.
Woman with little pug. Yes, which is, of course, a riff on his on his lady with lap dog. You're right, yes.
And also a lot of warmth, of the feeling of love and sometimes happiness in the stories, but as well as the poignancy. So were you, when you were writing them, were you injecting those elements, those tones into the writing, kind of in homage to Chekhov, or was that happening quite naturally because you were quite immersed in his work?
It's interesting. I was getting so much from his work, and on the one hand, I completely recognise, you know, the things that, especially if you teach Chekhov and you've read critics on Chekhov, the things that tend to get said a lot of Chekhov, and I can see it, but I don't think we're often really getting to the heart of what Chekhov does brilliantly. We talk about the provisionality of his short stories, that they don't have definitive end points for the characters, that characters are often left in a kind of motion, that things are not tidied off. We talk about his particularly modern kind of economy of writing. We know that his stories are less plotted. We know he doesn't favour the heroic, that his, he really favours an anti-heroic view of human nature. And we know that he can write with absolute stunning insight across every level of society, because of course he was the, you know, the grandson of a freed serf who then became a doctor and, you know, someone who moved through various levels of Russian society. But for me, what really comes through his work is the utter sense of compassion as a writer, and that moves me hugely in his work. So it moves me in his humour to laugh, and it moves me just profoundly in some deep place. I think that Chekhov is a great writer, not just because, yes, he brought in the provisional sort of kind of form of writing, a provisionality in the short story form, or doesn't tidy off his endings. I think he's a great writer because he somehow, and this is a hard phrase to break down, and perhaps it's questionable, but I think he does soul better than almost any writer. And I think he, perhaps more than anyone, aligned the short story with a sense of the human soul at an edge. And I find that exquisite and moving and mysterious, and I'm still trying to think about how he does it. His characters do not seem to be written. And that's perhaps the greatest compliment one writer can give another writer. They seem to exist separate from the author. They do not seem to be crafted or written. They seem merely to exist in their own slightly chaotic, slightly unpredictable, absolutely human way. But they do odd little things. They do not obey. Odd little moments come up that do not seem stray or incongruous or wrong. They're unexpected, but they make us believe even more, not less. These odd, incongruous details come in and make us believe more, not less, in the power of that character. And I always loved Chekhov, and Catherine Mansfield inherits this from Chekhov. Many of his characters are simply saying, and they literally say it quite often, I want to live, I want to live. And his stories, it seemed to me, placed yearning and desire, but absolutely profound human yearning, ordinary human lives, profound human yearning. And Catherine Mansfield picks that up. And I think, to some extent, that would be... what I feel I've inherited from Chekhov. I don't think my stories, apart from the Chekhov ones, maybe, but I think many of my short stories don't particularly look Chekhovian. You could look at a writer like Ewan Lee or William Trevor or Raymond Carver and see a more natural lineage on the page. But for me, it's the absolute, what I would love to learn from in Chekhov is a sense of getting compassion on the page, getting human desire and ordinary lives on the page, and getting human and human comedy and pathos together on the page. Life doesn't divide them, and nor does he.
So do you think that's what keeps bringing short story writers and, I'm sure, readers back to Chekhov, despite the fact that he was writing over 100 years ago, is those elements of compassion, soul in the writing, and, of course, this magic of creating characters that he doesn't seem to have created?
I think it really does. I think Chekhov allows us all to ask the question of how do we not get blunted in our lives? How do our lives not get blunted? How do we feel, how can we feel alive in our lives? It's a challenge, God knows. It's a challenge for almost every one of us at times, or much of the time, given, you know, just the sheer pressures of living and survival. But Chekhov looks at all sorts of beautiful, ordinary lives under pressure and says, how can I feel alive in my life? I want to live. So Lady with Lapdog, you know, Anna says, I want to live. And that is a refrain that goes through at least several of Chekhov's stories and then is echoed by Catherine Mansfield. And I suppose I wanted to echo it as well in that little, you know, that moment of inspiration, or that sound cry of inspiration that began with Chekhov. So, yes, I think, I'm not sure if I'm answering the question, sorry, but...
No, completely. I was interested in what you thought brought people back to Chekhov over and over again, and you mentioned yearning and desire and this need to be alive in your own life.
Yeah,
that... To have a kind of expression of who you are as a person, and it just struck me that that is the fundamental problem of the two characters in your story, the woman with little pug, and a problem that you highlight to the reader by almost removing the characters from their lives, in a sense. There's a shift in this story from watching without a page and then watching on the page, if you like, as the characters in the story become characters in a second sense.
Yes.
I'm trying to describe it without giving it away.
Without giving it away. No, it's tricky, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, if the story didn't have, I hope, a kind of compassion for its characters, and I hope something poignant, at the very least, then it might simply seem tricksy, and that would bother me. It might, you know, somebody might say, oh, she's going a bit postmodern there, and that's never in any way my intention. All I care about is delivering those characters alive onto the page, and any form of gimmicks or writing techniques, I never think in terms of technique or strategy. All I think about is what can I do to deliver that character most fully onto the page. And when we were speaking earlier, you were mentioning, I think it's Nabokov on Lady with Lapdog, and you know, his great reverence for that story, and of course the story being such a classic, and you know, going back to it, and isn't that a risk? And it did feel like a tremendous risk, and yet what I hoped is that I might carry it off. I began, and the prompt for it was really, really simple and a bit silly. It was simply that I came across a travel book that compared Yalta, the seaside resort of Yalta, calling it the new Brighton. Oh. And as a writer who lives and loves Brighton, and it's my adopted home, I thought, ah, oh, that's rather delicious. That means I could take Anna and Gurov from the original story and perhaps put them in Brighton, and what would happen? So again, it's that what if. What if I took Anna and Gurov out of late 19th century Yalta, seaside resort, on the promenade, and tried to recreate their movements and that kind of story here in Brighton in more or less present day? And so that was a little what if, and I didn't necessarily expect it to go anywhere. And once I became quite serious about it, and I did spend a long time then going back to Chekhov's letters and so on and so forth, and as you said, really attending to his warmth and his humour and all of that, and perhaps trying to absorb it in the crude way one might, and I realised I came up against a wall in writing that story, that either that it's not simply good enough to do a mirror form of the original story. It's not simply good enough to repeat a short story that's already been beautifully told and doesn't need anything more. So the only reason to go back and do an homage to it, or do a riff on it, or I'm making a different story, but it's one to pay my respects to it, to say this is how much I've enjoyed this story, but not to simply repeat it. So that meant I had to stop and really think, why am I writing this story? Why do I want to tell it? Well, I want to tell it because I'm so moved by the original story, in which Gurov, essentially he's a complete philanderer and cad, and was probably based on Chekhov's own fears about himself, who was really quite a philanderer. So if I was having dinner with him one night, many other women would be as well. And he's probably reflecting on himself at a certain age, writing that story, I believe, in 1899. He's almost 40 years old. He will die in 4 years. He already has TB. Life is ticking down for Chekhov, and he knows it. He's really now quite seriously ill, and for the first time ever, he's forming a relationship with one woman, with Olga Knipper, the actress for the Moscow Art Theatre. And so I knew, I was moved by all that. And being moved by something is always what inspires me most, I suppose. And I decided not to get tricksy, but to bring out or lift up for the reader that sense that we were speaking of earlier, of mortality built into the form of a story ticking down. And just as in the original, Anna and Gerov, and particularly Gerov, is beginning to feel his age, beginning to, you know, he's middle-aged, is beginning to feel the constraints of what life will not allow anymore, of chances that have gone, possibilities closed down, mortality coming up. And of course, Chekhov is writing with a very keen sense of all that. So I find it so moving to know that behind the story. I didn't know it originally, but I know it now. And to think, right, how might I echo that or do a fresh contemporary version of that? And so what I do in that story, without wanting to say too much, is that the characters begin to feel their own sense of mortality in an unexpected way as the story winds down. And they know that they too are ending. And at the very moment they're ending, they have discovered in their love something very profound and something that will not be ultimate, but nevertheless is big and is real for them.
So those themes are the ones that, for me anyway, weave through all three of these stories, even though after that first one, Woman with Little Pug, the next two, Chekhov's Telescope and The Death of Anton Chekhov by Anton Chekhov, deal with this poignancy of a life coming to an end, which you understand as a reader or is even shown to you in the story, combined with happiness through love or through memory. And this, for me, would pose a terrible problem as a short story writer, because it's so hard to write happy. It's very hard to write happy stories. And so I was delighted, actually, to watch Chekhov and Olga having fun together in Chekhov's Telescope. But the little boy in that story, who I think he's being employed by a journalist to follow Chekhov and try and dig some dirt, actually says there's no story in happiness. And I wondered how you dealt with putting love and happiness into these stories, whether again that's something that you would look to Chekhov to inspire you for, or do you find it a challenge?
I do. I think it is a real artistic challenge for a writer, and it's one I've thought about a fair bit, because to simplify it, stories thrive on trouble. You don't have a story if everything is simply happy. You know, then if everything's happy, it tends to be fairly consistent and fairly calm. A story needs conflict, it needs urgency, it needs pressure bearing down on its characters, because under pressure, they will show us who they really are. Only under pressure do we really see who a character is. So all of those things remain true, and that would be true of every story I've written, that I have to grasp what is really the conflict for the character here. What is their absolute pressure point? And as the overbearing author of them, I'm going to push them to the absolute pressure point, which they, in a sense, are not going to crack. I don't mean that, but they're going to open up, and they're going to they're going to be there. As V.S. Pritchett says, a good short story should capture a character at bursting point. At bursting point. That's what a good short story writer does. That said, I know, and I remember even one of my sisters saying this years ago, saying she finds short story collections a bit hard going because they can seem so grim. Because novels have big architecture, so novels can have, clearings, lots of light along with the shadow, clearings that open up, of bright sunshine, of big vistas, of beautiful scenarios. But there's something just more intensive about the narrative and the way it unfolds, and that intensity and that concentration on pressure in a short story. So how, therefore, can one possibly rustle up joy or anything life-affirming or redemptive? And I really, really wanted to think about that. I actually wrote in a communication with one of my writing friends. I said, I really want to try to do joy in this collection. It was almost a mission of how I could do that. So it was a preoccupation, certainly. You can never graft it on. And indeed, I really am always mindful. I think it was Flannery O'Connor in Mystery and Manners speaking about the redemptive ending and how absolutely nauseating it can be. I'm misquoting here, but that's the essence of it. That if it isn't hard won, if you haven't earned that, if the story and the terms, the imaginative logic of the story haven't earned joy, then you better not try to even begin to carry it off. It would be such a presumption, and your reader will never believe it, and they'll never trust you again, and that sort of thing, you know, or hardly. So it's, for me, it's the biggest artistic challenge to date, how to do joy. And, you know, it really, for me, took a lot of honesty in the writing, in the working with those characters, and it also made me decide that, you know, it has to be small moments carry great profundities and potentially carry joy. In the Chekhov story you've referred to, the death of Anton Chekhov by Anton Chekhov, there's a moment, almost a point of revelation, that comes together on the beach when the young journalist or reporter who's watching Anton and Olga in a very simple lover's moment on the beach understands, perhaps for the first time in his life, what love actually is and what a joyous thing in its utter simplicity it can be. That, you know, Chekhov is no hero. He's middle-aged, he's stooped, he's got TB. Olga is no particular beauty. You know, she's an ordinary woman and trying to do extraordinary things. And they're just two ordinary middle-aged lovers on a beach, and yet something quite profound happens. That's in the telescope, Chekhov's telescope, yes. Story. And later we see the same two characters with the same kind of love, and another moment of liftoff at the end of that story that comes as Chekhov dies and narrates with all the power of omniscience, because of course he's a writer and he's allowed omniscience, and omniscience is a bird's eye view of everything. So I decided, what if Chekhov could narrate as the great narrator his own death? What if, with his bird's eye vision, he could look down on himself and narrate his own final days? I would find that, I just thought, again, that was tantalizing, and I wanted to be able to do it.
Well, interestingly, that story, possibly for me as a reader anyway, holds even more joy than the other two, which sounds unlikely when we're looking at the death of Anton Chekhov. Partly because we've already seen him with Olga, and this joy, the simple joy of love that you described, feels absolutely right to me. And I think part of the reason it works is because they're not idealised lovers, and because he is coughing up blood on the beach, even as yes. they're enjoying each other's yes. company. But his sort of lightheartedness in his omniscience and his wry tone some of the time, which was also mixed together with quite genuinely sort of moving moments, and the way that you've chosen as a writer to express the change after death, come together to really make a joyous story out of a death in the death of Anton Chekhov.
I'm glad. I didn't want to write. I didn't want to publish a grim collection.
A miserable story.
No, I did want the stories to be hard, and hard in the sense that they're honest. But I wanted to see, partly as, I don't know, as a just as a writer living, I wanted to see if I could communicate joy and nothing that was easily won, nothing that was too tidy or too stuck on. I wanted it to be earned. So I had to work really hard on each story. I think The Heart of Dennis Noble is perhaps another one, near death but attains something like joy or at least delight in life. And even for Sylvia Plath, I've got tired of all the grim intensity around Absolutely. Plath and Hughes, and I wanted is in the simplest of ways, and in a way it's inconsequential, but I wanted to try to give her something back in death, something small, which was just a bright moment in her post-death narratives, of which there are many, 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 and all the grimness and all the intensity. I just sort of felt she doesn't deserve that. She deserves a light moment. She deserves a bit of comedy. She deserves a bit of playfulness. Because look at the beauty that shines up from her work. You know, look at the images, look at the strangeness, look how connected she was to life and to living things, and was, you know, put out these incredible hymns to the natural world. Strange, but powerful and absolutely alive. So I thought, you know, why not give her back? Just rest her, at least for the space of 10 pages, rest her from all of the grim pouring over her life. I just wanted to break free of that.
She has become, it's a horrible phrase, but a bit of a poster girl for misery. And it was fun as a reader to see the fun in your story, actually, the fun that the protagonist visiting the grave has, thinking about Sylvia and how she relates to her, and just the image of Sylvia on the sticks with
Yes, on the river Styx, yeah. in a sort of fiberglass swan boat, yeah. as they have. She would have known from the Boston Public Garden, you know. Or it's quite likely she knew. They certainly are there today, and they've been there for a long time.
Yeah.
So yes, to do something silly and to give both of them, you know, if they'd grown into, you know, late middle age together, or even on, you know, even both of them alive, who am I to say? I'm no one to say this, but, you know, if anyone ever has been divorced and you get years beyond that, you can really be quite comfortable and okay with the past, but they never quite had that chance. And so I wanted, in a way, to give them both that sense of just being okay with the past and at ease within it, and even to give them not so much a lover's moment, it's not that, but to give her in particular a bright image that story ends on.
And it's her voice that we hear coming through as well, of course. And so in this collection we have the voices of two writers from beyond the grave. We hear from Sylvia and we hear from Chekhov in his
Yes,
own narration.
Yes, I hadn't thought of that. Yes, we do. Yes.
Which is fantastical in a way, but also I felt made perfect sense as it started to happen within the story. Partly because you'd used an interesting device in that story where you reminded us of the difference in the two calendars that were running
yes,
in Russia at
yeah.
the time. I wondered if you could read us a little bit of the story and we could hear perhaps the opening and some of the section that deals with the time difference.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that'd be lovely to do. Yes, yeah, so you're right. The Russian calendar at this time did not agree with the European calendar. And so when in Chekhov's diaries, when he travels west to Europe, he's usually following the Russian calendar, but then biographers will have different dates on it, which pointed to the discrepancy for me. And I immediately, because of this whole interest in reality not being such a fixed, reliable thing. Well, the time even isn't fixed and reliable. It seemed to me then perhaps there are chinks of being or chinks of reality we don't fully have a handle on, or at least I could pretend. So if I read from the opening page of The Death of Anton Chekhov by Anton Chekhov. So that is the full title. I'll just read the first couple of paragraphs. Omniscience, and I should say that this is narrated, this is the voice of Anton Chekhov, ostensibly. Omniscience is, admittedly, a dubious gift. Olga and I look very small indeed as we step from the carriage and peer up at the splendour of the Hotel Romerbod. Above its mansard roof and towers, the swallows dip and soar, and like them, I can see the balding crown of my own head and the soft yellow flutter of a handkerchief as Olga pats the heat from my face. It is humid, and the trees of the estate stoop under lush canopies of every shade of green. This weather needs to break, Olga tells me, but I'm distracted by a swallow as it swoops low to drink from the hotel's ornamental pond. It neither pauses in its flight nor misses a single wing beat. Coins glint in Olga's palm as she tips our driver. I watch a porter manhandle our bags. Thank God he does. It's work enough to find my hat and to straighten my bow tie, not to mention myself, for I am bent and irritable after the long journey. So that's the beginning. He's not well. They've arrived at this spa in Germany, where the hope is that he will recover. But in fact, he's really actually just weeks away. He doesn't know it. In his diaries, he doesn't know it. So this is an account of the actual place and their arrival. But I've added swallows and so on. Yes. So if I turn and to the little bit that you mentioned, Zoe, about the calendars. Yes. And let me just see if I find that. From the end of the story, when Chekhov's really in the last moments of life. But bits of his own humour, I think, I hope, come through. It is in the small hours of both the 2nd of July and the 15th of July that my heart stops. Lev is with us, and the good doctor too, whom Lev roused from his bed. I hear Olga gasp. I see her grab our friend the doctor by the lapels and insist he do something. But dead or alive, my heart is stubborn, and no amount of crushed ice will persuade it to start. Dr. Schrauer shakes his head, and I feel Lev tenderly close my eyes. Lev leads Olga to our balcony and speaks with her until dawn. As the sky pales, they smell the hay from the fields. Somewhere a bell ringer practices. Later that day, Lev and Dr. Schrauer have a job getting me into the white and blue suit for my laying out. I never was anyone's straight man, and, true to myself, I died doubled up on my side. Never let it be said that I don't amuse myself. I am reliably informed that the authorities would much prefer it if I didn't amuse myself, for as I narrate the story of my own demise, it would seem I fall foul of decree number 02030 issued by the central office. This thoughtful decree bans, quote, the publication of any letter or book that might trivialise or discredit Anton Chekhov, unquote. On my head be it.
So is that a real decree?
It is a real decree. Actually, he wouldn't have known about it because, of course, it came after his death. But it is a real decree put out in Soviet times that their great writer, Anton Chekhov, could not be diminished or trivialised by any publication.
Well, you've certainly stuck to the rules.
Thank God not. I hoped, in trying to pay great homage to him, that by capturing his humour, that was one of the best ways in which I could possibly do it. And the other thing I perhaps think that I find as a writer so interesting about Chekhov, and again, when I read at least standard criticism on Chekhov, I don't see this said enough. I don't see anyone recognising it enough that that he's not purely realist, as we all assume. His reality is bend. His sense of reality is quite a fluid thing, and although we tend to credit, let's say, James Joyce and Virginia Woolf with stream of consciousness, and it's true that, that the term came much later, but Chekhov actually does stream of consciousness. So his reality at the moment, say, when Dr. Ragin in a story called Ward 6 is dying, we get a wonderful paragraph in Dr. Ragin's final moments of life, when he sees animals, I can't remember the animals, are they gazelles? That might be Catherine Mansfield echoing Chekhov. But he has a whole, he thinks about, for example, this is perhaps not right, the post office and the gazelle. We get those final but quite translucent moments of life, and it's completely stream of consciousness. And so he is always stretching reality, even though we think of him as a pure, you know, pure realist. But he's not. His sense of the absurd, his sense of the surreal, is there all the time, and his sense of how strange our inner lives are.
Well, that's something that he does that's pleasingly echoed in this story, I think. And I felt that your use of this difference between the calendar dates and where that kind of can finally take us in the narrative, you'll have to read it to find out what I mean, was beautifully done and opened me up to this possibility that reality is not going to be quite the kind you can pin down in this story. And you used a line which I think is an Armenian fairy tale.
I believe so.
Which is a bit like how once upon a time, but it is, there was a time and no time. And it's in there in italics, and it's telling us something important.
Yes.
And again, it shifts away the kind of definite surface under your feet and lets you accept very easily watching Chekhov as he moves from his life into his death and then continue to narrate the story for us and without any question at all. And I really liked the way that functions in the same way as a fairy tale opening functions to remind you not to expect things to go predictably here.
Yes, that's exactly what it does. I hope it does. And it takes us into a fairy tale mind, a mindset that allows, again, for reality to be stretchier than we might imagine it to be as we stand at bus stops and catch our trains and so on. So there was a time and no time is, as you say, a line. I believe it's either an echo of it or it's the actual line that Angela Carter put her finger on years ago in her introduction. I think it's not quite the same, but I've come up against other versions of it being either Russian or Armenian. And because Chekhov had such a vivid, vivid boyhood, going out with his brother onto the steppe, the Russian steppe, and really wild days, and coming up against Cossack communities, and even living with, you know, a very traditional Cossack family for a time. Again, I thought he'd have access to those traditions that relate to folktale mind or fairy tale mind, and have a really natural understanding of it. So I don't expect that Chekhov entirely trusted, you know, cause and effect reality either. I expect he at least, even though he was a doctor and clearly had an extremely good medical, rational mind, I also feel he knew about the way in which reality is stranger than we sometimes can process.
And I think as a short story writer myself, that sounds like one of the most important lessons you can learn from Chekhov about what you can do with the short story or what its possibilities are, not to follow the rules of reality, but to present something stranger, something that's slightly twisted, that takes us away from the reality of the world, but and therefore has a deeper meaning in it. And honours life and shows us joy, but without doing it in the way that
Yes, I absolutely agree. It's about, who is it? Again, maybe it's Pritchett. To glimpse that which lies buried in the human heart. I'm slightly misquoting, but to that which lies buried in the human heart. And I think Chekhov does that, and perhaps heart is actually soul. And souls, perhaps, our spirits, understand reality in different ways than straight realism. Ultimately, it's only about, the job of the writer is about getting to the truth, and as big a truth as one can manage.